comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful planet we call Earth, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. Well, tonight is going to be a very special night. It's going to be a very special night because we're going to be talking with Anthony Sanchez. He is the author of the newly released ebook called, well, I should say the newly released book. It's been released first as an ebook, and it is called The UFO Highway. Now, I promised you that when that book became available, I would purchase the book and I would read it. And I have. And I've got to tell you, folks, I think it's well worth purchasing and reading. You're going to hear some of why tonight. Now, this book deals with, it's built around an interview that Anthony Sanchez had with a retired U.S. Air Force colonel. And this colonel claims that he worked at the much rumored Dulce underground base. Now, when I say much rumored, we've heard lots about this, you know, and there are people that say, oh, it can't be true, it's not true, it's been discredited, and so forth. Okay, well, maybe. Maybe not. Some of what we hear in the, well, we've got something weird happening with our video. I don't know what, whatever it was. But some of what we hear with the Dulce base, some of that is in this book. And, you know, some of it is the same as what you've heard. But I got to tell you, there's a whole lot of information in here, in this book, that is not what you have heard before. There's a lot of information in this book that is completely different from what you have heard, and diametrically opposed to some of what you have heard. So we're going to have the opportunity to talk with Mr. Sanchez this evening. We're going to have the opportunity to delve into this book now that it's been published. We'll be able, because it's been published, to talk about some things he was unable to talk about previously in other interviews. And so it should prove to be very, very interesting. And we're going to do this show just a little bit differently than normal. Now, what we're going to do is, for the first 2 hours, we're just going to hear from Mr. Sanchez. I'm going to talk with him. I'll be asking him questions, discussing things with him related to the book. And then we're going into overtime, after hours. And that's when I'll be opening up the telephone lines. Normally, I open up the telephone lines in the second hour. Tonight, it will be after the second hour. We shall return with Mr. Sanchez right after this. welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Mr. Anthony Sanchez. Now, as I said at the top of the show, he is the author of this newly published book. It's out right now, available right now in ebook format. And it is called The UFO Highway. I told you that I would purchase the book. I told you that I would read it and that I would report back to you. Well, rather than just giving you a review as I had planned, we have Mr. Sanchez with us this evening, and it is a delight for me to be able to say, Anthony, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you, Kevin. It's an honor to be on your show.
Anthony, let me give a little bit of sort of introductory and groundwork, lay some groundwork here, and then we'll dive off into this. Folks, you need to understand that this book has as its foundation an interview with a colonel, a retired U.S. Air Force colonel, and he's talking about his work and years of work, actually, at what we call the Dulce Base. Now, this is a rumor, this thing about the base. It's just been a rumor. We heard Phil Schneider talk about it. He talked about a firefight that took place there, and that a bunch of people got killed or injured, and a bunch of these Grays got injured, and then lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people chimed in, wrote all their opinions about whether they thought he was telling the truth or not. It was a minefield for Mr. Sanchez to step off into that because there had been so many pronouncements made by people, some who sort of make these pronouncements as though, hey, look, I'm the expert. This is what I say, and you should believe it because I'm the expert. They may be right. However, after you read this book, you'll have questions for those experts as well. Mr. Sanchez puts a statement right in the beginning of the book, right near the beginning of the book, and it's a disclaimer. It says, the opinions expressed in this interview are the interviewee's own personal views and do not reflect those of the author or publisher in any way whatsoever. And so what he presents to us, what Mr. Sanchez presents to us, is the transcript of the interview, and it is rather eye-popping. This is different than a lot of the big revelations that come out, and this is a pretty big revelation, I got to tell you. But this is different. This is different because Mr. Sanchez has done some things to try to vet this information, to try and nail down whether this is true information as much as possible, including subjecting the colonel to two polygraph tests. And we'll get into some other things that he has done to try and nail this down. Now, having said all of that, Anthony, how did you come into contact with this colonel in the first place?
Yeah, so I was working as a software engineer at a major semiconductor firm here in Northern California. And this is about 2007. And I was doing computational metrics analysis, which is essentially programming scripts for engineers who are testing integrated circuits on these multi-million dollar tester machines. And there were two groups there. There was the engineering corps, and there was the technician corps. I was part of the engineering corps because I was a software engineer. that means I was a regular employee of the company, and, you know, I was there for years. I was there for 4 years at the time. There was a high turnover rate as part of the technician corps, and I don't know why that is. You know, but anyhow, one day, this individual joins the company, an English gentleman, and every other Wednesday, I'm down in the lab, in the test lab, and I'm staying late evenings doing some work. And I ended up meeting this individual, talking with him, and lo and behold, you know, he finds out that I have a blog on my UFO research that I've done. I've been doing UFO research since 1989, 1990. And he was interested in that, and we became friends, and we talked, and, you know, we would see each other every few weeks. And I guess the relationship lasted for about 5 months. And on our last meeting, which I was unaware that it was our last meeting, we went to this Filipino restaurant in Folsom, and he brought up my blog, and he asked me, you know, if I had any interest in top secret classified military projects. And I said, well, it kind of comes natural, you know, to, you know, the UFO research field. I said, but I hadn't done anything specific with regards to top secret, you know, classified, you know, weaponry. And he said, what about defense systems? And I, you know, and then we got into this conversation, and I went back to, we went back to work. A week later, I'm asking where this person is, and I was informed he just left. He's gone. You know, he just gave no notice. He just left. About a year later, I get a phone call, and I recognize the guy's voice. Oh, hey, what's going on? And I said, what happened? Why did you leave? So we start talking, and midway through the conversation, he drops his English accent, which shocked the hell out of me, because I thought, I believed the guy was English. And he has a full-blown American accent, and he says, and he told me that he wanted to share some information with me, and because he knew I was a writer, he knew I was planning on putting out a book one day. And so we got into this whole conversation about this defense system that he had been working on, and it turns out he was AWOL. He admitted to me that he was AWOL from a project, a classified federal project, was a well-known defense contractor over in the Bay Area near Moffett Field, and that he was sort of a conscientious objector to what they were doing. And he abandoned the project, and he was in big trouble for it, and he was on the run. And he told me he was part of this underground, and I really didn't buy it at that time, until he started feeding me strange bits of information and serious, you know, high-level info on this project that he was working on. And that's when I knew the guy was the real deal. I was like, wow, these are real, you know, government documents. What's he giving it to me for? And before I knew it, you know, he wanted to use me as a channel for his disclosure. He wanted to get this information out there. I was really intrigued because of what I was reading. With my own technical background, I was able to understand that what I was looking at was real. And I had to take a step back at that point and inform him that no, I'm not going to release this because I don't want to land in a federal prison. It's too tied into, you know, what's happening now with, you know, our military, and this is really, really, you know, high level info, and I really didn't want to get into. I didn't want to put it out in my book. I actually sent it to another researcher. I told him, if you're brave enough to put this out there, go ahead, but I don't think they will. So this individual and I, we did stay in touch, and he did continue to give me more info. And about January of this year, he contacts me and says, I have an individual that would like to talk with you. he saw your website, and he was interested in talking with you because of some information that you had touched on with regards to your alien-human hybridization. And I said, oh, you mean my human origins, my transformation hypothesis? He said, yes. And I said, okay, well, who is it? And he goes, well, I can't give you any names, not now, until you've had a phone conversation with the guy. He's a retired United States Air Force colonel. And that's all he would tell me. So that was about the beginning. It was just a couple days, actually, before I got the call. So I get a phone call from this gentleman, and we speak, and it's the colonel. And he starts telling me the story about how he was part of a classified medical detachment out of McClellan Air Force Base near Sacramento. Well, I'm located right near Sacramento, so I was really interested, because this is a place that I could physically go to and check out, you know, details of his story. And I was just blown away by what he told me. And that's how I met. And this other person, who I refer to as Trinity, is the person that got me in contact with the colonel. So,
okay. Yeah, now, the colonel, before he would tell his story to you, insisted on anonymity. He insisted upon some security measures. Briefly describe for us the security measures he set up for himself.
First of all, the phone that he called me on was not his. It was one of those prepaid cell phones. And every conversation that I've ever had with him, he's contacted me on a prepaid cell phone. So I write those numbers down in the hope that I can contact him back. Only once have I ever been able to contact him back using this phone, using these cell phones. We did have a private meeting at his office where he worked. This is an educational institution, higher level. And that's when I knew this person was not lying to me about, you know, what he does for a living, what he did in the past. There just was something very, very genuine about him. That's when I decided, okay, this
okay,
guy...
Okay, well, let's pause right here. You say, or you've published in the book, he tells what it is he does. So share that with the audience. What is it that he does now for a living?
He is actually a professor of psychology. He has 2 postgraduate degrees in psychology, and he teaches at a Northern California university.
Okay.
I can't say which university, but that's okay. What he does.
Okay, so you met him at his office at this university.
Yes, the first time we ever met was at his office.
Okay.
And that's the night we decided, okay, this is real. This is going to happen. Let's conduct an interview. Now, I'm about to give you a piece of information that I've never shared with anyone, so this is an exclusive for your show, Kevin.
Okay.
When we conducted the interview, this was at his residence, one of his residences. This was at a cabin just outside of Auburn, California. And I've never told that to anyone except Norio Hayakawa. So this is the first that I'm, you know, giving this bit of information out. So our interview was actually conducted inside a cabin of which he and his wife own in and around, I'm going to say Auburn, California, between Auburn and Grass Valley. That's all I can divulge on that.
All right.
And I was allowed, by the way, to give that information out because they're no longer going to be owning that cabin, from what I know, what I was told. So, anyhow, we conducted the interview at the cabin. We conducted the polygraph examinations at the cabin. And I had a retired law enforcement officer here in Northern California who's now an acting private investigator conduct the polygraph examinations. We did 2 within one day, 4 hours apart. And the results were the same both times. I specifically architected questions so that the examiner wouldn't understand the nature of the facility that we were questioning, but the colonel had full understanding that every question related to Dulcie and his involvement with Dulcie. And
so what were the results of the polygraph exams?
The results were that he was telling the truth. He was very, very truthful. There was no ambiguity in anywhere in the results.
Okay, now he also provided you with a document. And this document is called a DD-214. These are the discharge papers that military people get when they're discharged from the military.
That is correct.
He provided you with his DD-214, a copy of which you reproduce in your book, and you've blacked out his name and his ID number.
The only areas redacted were those that could identify him.
Now, this is where I've got a question, okay? And he talked about that he was, as soon as this interview was over, he was going to move, he would transfer within his organization or whatever, he was going to move, his family would follow, and he talked about, you know, steps he was taking to make sure he stayed safe. But by giving you the DD-214, he did so knowing that you would use that, you would check to see if he is who he says he is. Mm-hmm. So when you did any checking on this DD-214, you would be, for instance, if you requested verification that he served, verification that he's listed as having served, and so forth, the military, the government, makes a record of those requests.
That's
now
correct.
The book is out.
Mm-hmm.
Now that the book is out, and I can tell you, I absolutely guarantee you, government computers from east to west to north to south are lit up tonight listening to this show. It'll take them all of 2 seconds to enter your name and see who you searched for, and they'll know who it is.
And that's where you're wrong.
Okay, tell me why I'm wrong.
Because we filed a standard form 180. The colonel and I. But it wasn't my information. We didn't use my information. All I've ever said was, is I'm very familiar with the process of filing a standard Form 180 because I do it all the time.
All right, we have to step away for break, Anthony. Yep. We'll be back, folks, and we'll hear more about this when we come back. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Mr. Anthony Sanchez, author of UFO Highway. And just when we went to break, I had said that because Anthony did a search and asked for information about this colonel based on that DD-214, that it would take all of about 2 seconds for them to run a search now and figure out that Anthony Sanchez asked about a particular name, and they would identify this colonel. And he said, that's where you're wrong, Anthony. Tell me why I'm wrong.
It was because the colonel actually filed the standard Form 180. All that it did was, all that I asked for was that it came directly to me. So we used my private mailbox, my P.O. box, the same address that is listed. I better not say that, but it went to a private mailbox.
Okay. Now here's another thing.
Yeah.
all they have to do is look in your book, and hopefully a whole bunch of government guys will buy your book. That'll be good for the book sales.
Sure.
So all they have to do is look in the book and look at the DD-214 as you have reproduced it. And just from the information that's on that DD-214 and his information about what he did, what his job was, they know who it is.
Of course they know who it is, but he's not that person anymore. He's completely changed his identity. He's changed his appearance. He's changed everything.
I mean,
using his resources, he has a new Social Security number, a new name, a new face, everything.
Okay. So now comes the big question. Since, of course, they will know. Of course they know. Why is the name blacked out? If that's not him anymore, why can't we see the name?
That's a good question. That was what he requested.
Okay. All right. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, but possibly because of... if his name was there, there could be relatives that could be tracked down by people, you know, the general public, which I don't think he wanted.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm making that assumption. But when he asked that, that's what I thought. My immediate assumption was, oh, well, there's probably, you know, people that could be tracked based on his information, you know, his old information that he's probably also trying to protect.
All right. Now... before I ask this question, I'm going to set this up with some other information.
Okay.
I've got a couple of other people that have read this book that I'm in communication with, so we could compare notes and think together about what are the things we really need to focus on. One of those people has told me that substantially what this colonel is saying about this base is factual. And I won't get into how this person has a basis to know that. If he ever wants to step forward and say, he can do so, but he says it's factual. And the only way that colonel could have known, the only way that person could have known is to have been there. However, having said that now, let's go back to the DD-214 and have the colonel requests that the name be blacked out. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
He's changed his name. He's got a new identity. And yet, for sure they're going to know who that was with that DD-214. Is it possible that this guy, who, and I didn't meet him, you did, so that's why I'm asking you. Is it possible that this guy you met with, who gave you this interview, is a disinformation agent having given you substantially the facts, but maybe slipped some disinformation into it, provided you with a DD-214 that isn't his?
I don't think so. Because the process of which the DD-214 was acquired was done through a strict protocol. And it came directly from the custodian of military records. So I mean, it's possible, but I personally don't think so.
Okay. All right. Now, let's get into the story a little bit. And before we get into the story, let me say, because of certain things that have happened, certain people that have come forward with spectacular information previously, and because eventually... people were investigating and digging up information and eventually proved some of these spectacular stories to be fraudulent, or at least to be not true. Because of that, I have reservations about the identity of this person that you interviewed. Now, I'm not saying it's not really the colonel. I'm saying I have reservations about whether it is or not, because it really could be someone involved in what's called perception management or perception manipulation operation. And it could have all been planned that he would supply and that they would supply a DD-214, knew the request would be coming, and had it all set up. That's always possible.
Yeah.
However, there are things about this story that, although spectacular, do seem to have the ring of truth about them. So let's dive into this. One thing that I've been hearing, you know, we keep talking about, you know, who's in charge of the UFO information. Is it the CIA? Is it Naval Intelligence? Is it, you know, who is it? Who is it that's involved with managing UFO information? And I've been hearing from people fairly recently, over the past couple of years, no, it's not the CIA, it's not the NSA, it's not the FBI, it's not Naval Intelligence, it's not any of those groups that we normally talk about. It's the Department of Energy. And that's what the colonel says. He says that too. Did that surprise you?
Yes. Yes, because I would have suspected it would have been, you know, a different organization.
Well, he tells the story of why it's the Department of Energy. It goes back to 1938, mm-hmm. and it has to do with Einstein and others urging the president to jump into research into nuclear weapons, and to do so with haste, because according to the colonel, the Germans were already at it. They were already working on it.
That's right.
Okay, so let's go back now to the time when this underground base that today we refer to as the Dulce base was discovered, this underground installation was discovered. And as I understand it, it was kind of discovered sort of accidentally.
That's right. So when they were searching for a new home for our future atomic development programs, they were, you know, already looking throughout New Mexico, Nevada, parts of northern Arizona, even southern Colorado. And there was this group called the Muroc Expedition, which were, you know, a group of select individuals. I would imagine there had to have been more than one team, but this one team in particular was working in the northern New Mexico region, and they happened upon this cavern, this very, very large cavern, which is now no longer there. It's been since covered up and, you know, expertly concealed. And inside of this cavern is where they had made this discovery initially of what they just thought was a fight which had occurred between some, you know, Apache Indians with someone else. And upon deeper investigation within the cavern, they began to find artifacts. They began to find bodies which were not human, and technological artifacts, things that were far more advanced than anything that we had possessed at that point in time. This was an immediate cause for alarm, and the commanding officer at that time, you know, had sense enough to prevent these soldiers from damaging or touching anything, and called in, experts to help excavate what it was they had found. And there was also that initial engagement with these inhabitants at that time.
Okay, so let's pause for a moment. Some of the artifacts that they found, and this was an eye-opener for me when I read this, they found giant screen, flat screen monitors attached to the walls in this cavern. And they found other electronic devices. They didn't even know what these were when they found them. But as it turns out, it's giant flat screens. And so, you know, they were amazed at what they were seeing, because obviously back then there was no such thing as a flat screen monitor. In fact, there was no such thing as a computer monitor. Those didn't come along for quite some time.
That's right.
In fact, computers didn't come along for quite some time.
That is correct. So a lot of the equipment that they saw initially, which were probably, I mean, computers, you know, with the understanding of what we understand, with the understanding of what we know them to be now, these guys were calling them electric typewriters, electronic typewriters, and cryptograph machines. You know, those were the most sophisticated type devices at that time that had anything resembling a keyboard or, so that's probably why they made, those guesses as to what they may be.
Mm-hmm.
So, I personally would love to have seen what it was they were looking at.
All right. Now, they also found some very thin pieces of metal with etchings on it and on them, and the etchings were later determined to be a sort of very sophisticated cuneiform. Apparently the parent language of the Sumerians, the parent language of the Assyrians, etc. And they were able to translate these.
That's correct.
They refer to them as tablets. Now, in your book, you have an artist's rendition of one of these.
Yeah.
How were you able to come up with what that would look like?
Just based on the description provided by the colonel, he said these were metal sheets, flat metal sheets, with precision-like etching of cuneiform on them. One of the things that I've always speculated on was, if they had these advanced computers, why were they etching onto these thin metal sheets? And later, I was able to determine that it was because...
We'll stay on the edge of our seats because we have to take a break. We'll come back to why they were etching on these thin metal sheets right after this. We stepped away for break. Anthony, you were just about to tell us what you figured out as to, they've got all this advanced equipment, so why are they doing these etchings onto thin metal sheets? Why?
Yeah, so I later was able to, ascertain enough information to come up with this idea that if they have this strong reverence for these progenitors, the inhabitants, the Greys, for this progenitor race, which they tend to worship, it would make sense that they would not want to put their history and their doctrine electronically. They would want to, like any other religion, they would want to, have it in a more, permanent type of record, which would make sense that they would put them on these metal sheets, which they kept in libraries.
So these metal sheets, then, are sort of their Bible.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Okay. All right, now let's talk about what's on these metal sheets.
Yeah, there's lots of information on the metal sheets, not just their religious doctrine, but there's also technical specifications. There's also so it's their history, it's their religious doctrine, and there's actually like technical libraries. That's what I was able to extract from my interview with the colonel.
All right, we'll come back to those in just a little bit, maybe. But what happens is this expedition team called the Muroc Expedition, it's called Muroc Expedition because they're sent from or assembled at and then sent from the Muroc Army Air Base. And so it's called Muroc Expedition. So they get into a conflict with these little grays. They run into them in the cave and get into a conflict with them, according to the colonel. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so they had been there, and they had already started to extract a lot of this technology that they had found. And what happened was, as they went deeper into the I don't want to call it a facility at that point, because it was more of a, the opening was more natural at that time. Before, you know, the deeper they went in, they found these more artificial type structures. But anyhow, the deeper they did go in, they started noticing that there was somebody or something there, and they actually went through a period of cat and mouse type of if you read that part of the book, you can sense it was more of like a, you know, is there someone there? Are they seeing something, or is it just in their head? And then ultimately they realize, yes, there is somebody, something intelligent, something or someone intelligent down here, and they don't want us here. So there were, you know, they were wrapping up their camp, and they had extracted just about everything that they could without going too deep, for purposes of safety. Because they hadn't understood, they weren't going to abandon the place, but they were going to back off, study and then analyze what it was they had extracted from the facility. But there were two individuals who broke protocol and triggered an engagement.
How did they break protocol?
Well, they were ordered not to leave the group. And they were also ordered not to go down these corridors that they had found. It was too soon. And they needed to, you know, perform analysis and understand what it was exactly they were dealing with or who it was. And these two guys went down one of these corridors. They went really deep into the facility, and they ended up alerting these individuals to their presence, and that triggered disengagement.
All right. The little gray guys, according to their tablets, according to those metal sheets, this is information that most of us would not have been exposed to. Because when we think of the grays, we're usually thinking they are from off Earth. But according to their tablets, they were created by what they call the progenitor race right here on Earth.
That's right. That's right. So if we take a look at this history of the various groups that are involved, you have this, what they refer to, like you, as you mentioned, these progenitors. So this progenitor race, which was, from a different star system, ended up here in our solar system, and for the purposes of colonizing Mars. And apparently there was a catastrophic event on Mars, which had occurred, and they were there for some time before, you know, they realized the damage was too great, they had to leave. And I don't think at that time they had the means to facilitate traveling back to where they came from. I'm not exactly clear on this whole part of this because I never got full, you know, information from the colonel, but it sounds as if they had left this other star system because of their planet there was dying or whatever, so they had to find something suitable, and Mars was suitable for their physiology, not so much Earth, because it was believe it or not, Earth was not you know, suitable for their long-term survival without, you know, some type of you know, artificial means of surviving. So when this catastrophic event happened on Mars, after some time, they came to Earth. And when they did come to Earth, this progenitor race, they began to die off. And they realized if they were going to continue, they would have to create a genetically enhanced offspring, which they did. They created a genetically enhanced offspring, which they thought would be able to withstand you know, the harshness of Earth's environment on their physiology. At that same time, they also created a non-progenitor genetic creation, meaning this was a species that they created genetically, artificially, but which was definitely sentient and highly intelligent, that would serve them and their offspring. Now, ultimately, these progenitors would die off, but their offspring, who were essentially exactly like them, but had a better chance at surviving on Earth, they would, you know, become, you know, rulers or whatever, and they would have these grays service them and actually act as a as overseers to the indigenous hominid population here on Earth, you know, what we would refer to as the earliest vestiges of humanity at that time.
Okay, so essentially they are biological, but I understand they do not have the DNA of the progenitor race. They are biological. I'm curious about the term sentient. We hear from lots and lots and lots of people who have had contact with Greys, mm-hmm, that they're almost robotic.
Yes.
So they're like biological machines, like biological computers, which, by the way, are have been invented and are being tested and improved on in the UK.
Yes. So these grays, they don't reproduce like a typical you know, earth-based you know, animal life form. They don't procreate in the same form. They're created in a lab. They're genetic. They're created using genetic materials.
Okay, so they're cloned.
They're clones, essentially.
Okay.
So, back to this this genetically, you know, enhanced offspring. This first group, the Anu, they.
Okay. Now, how do we know they're called Anu?
Because it's in the. It was in. This was relayed to me by the colonel through the information that he had based on what he learned through this repository at DSD-3 in Dulce. These DSD-3 historical repositories, sort of like a cultural reference to the inhabitants, the Greys.
Okay, so this information was in those tablets, in those sheets that were etched?
Yes.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in the second hour, wow, what a tragedy that you missed the first hour. Believe me, that is not hyperbole. But we're glad you're here now, and we're talking with Anthony Sanchez. Anthony is the author of UFO Highway, and we're talking about this interview that he had with a U.S. Air Force colonel, in which the colonel related to him information about an underground facility. We, in the UFO community, have come to call it the Dulce Base. And a lot of information that we haven't heard before. Anthony, when we went away for break, I asked the question, you mentioned that the progenitor race created a genetically altered version of themselves, offspring, to be better equipped to handle Earth's environment, and they were called the Anu. And I had asked, how do we know that it was called Anu? And you had said that that's what the colonel said, that's what they were called in these tablets. Am I correct?
That's right.
Okay. So they also have these little gray guys that were created by the progenitor race. They are not hybrids of themselves. They do not share DNA. And they are essentially biological kind of computers, I guess.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Kevin?
They are essentially biological computers in that...
That is right. That is a good description of them.
Okay. All right.
That is a good description of them.
So then the Anu, what happened to them?
So the Anu began to, you know, unfortunately for them, they still were not, you know, genetically perfect, you know, as their forebears had, you know, had hoped.
Okay.
So they had become afflicted with the same type illnesses that were caused at the genetic level because, you know, to their physiology because of the harshness of Earth's environment. So they had to create another enhanced genetically offspring. So essentially, they're just repeating the process that, you know, that created them.
Okay.
So they created this group, and this is the most important group, this Astra Albus group, because this group came into existence when the Greys already existed, you know, so this younger group. But this group also was still not right, and the only salvation that they would have with regards to maintaining their ability.
Are you
was
still there?
To essentially interbreed,
okay,
with a modern human. So at that time, when the Astra Albus were created, the Anu had actually genetically enhanced the indigenous early human population, which created modern human, a much more intelligent human, which we would consider what we are today.
Okay.
Now, of that group, females were chosen for interbreeding with these Astra Albus, because they were now capable of it, and that is what created the modern Astra Albus, which is this alien-human hybrid, which is still active as a lineage today.
The colonel talks about the Astra Albus and tells us that they are the elite who are basically running everything and the rest of us are slaves. I would have to depart from the colonel there, because I know there are people who are ostensibly elite. They think they are anyway. And they this whole idea of, you know, the whole feudal system was based on the idea that the elite were, they were the elite because they had a divine right to be the elite, and it was their lineage. And, of course, they practiced all kinds of interbreeding, keeping the lineage pure. Interbreeding, however, turns out some rather significant and spectacular idiots. Not always, but it does. And, of course, royal families have not been devoid of idiots. Many royal families have had some of these, and some of them have actually ascended to the thrones in their countries. But the idea that these people have some kind of a right to rule the rest of us because of their lineage, you know, you only need to go back and look at the Romanov family and see what happens when a population says no. And you know, this whole idea, this is another point where the Colonel's story to me gets a little suspicious. As possible, maybe this is one of the threads of disinformation that may be in it. I'm not saying it is, but it has those possibilities, because it sort of gives some underpinning to the idea that these people have some kind of lineage right to be the elite. And I got to tell you, man, powerful people are only as powerful as the rest of us let them be.
That's that's part of the message that was being conveyed by the Colonel, essentially that the masses are sheep. And they're being ruled by this elite in power over, you know, however many eons.
Well, you know, as just because, you know, he's a senator. Or, well, you know, he's a prime minister. And you're just, you know, gaga over that. You know, give me a freaking break. These people breathe oxygen, they eat food, and they do a few other things that are not flattering. And they're just like the rest of us. And I don't care if they think they have Oster Albus blood in them or not. Mm-hmm. They're only as powerful as the rest of us let them be. And if the people, for instance, look how long it took before Milosevic was arrested. It didn't happen till the people in Serbia said that's enough. And they took him down. Ceausescu in Romania, oh, he was one of the elite. And he terrorized that country, absolutely raped that country. And when they'd had enough, they took him down. And, Maybe I misread what the Colonel intended there. Maybe he's trying to point out that this is what they think, that they are the ruling elite because they are Oster Albus lineage. They are the elite because the rest of us let them be.
I don't know the whole picture. But based on what information I have, it seems that this group has managed to, you know, maintain this structure, you know, through wealth and it's wealth which empowers them.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially makes all of us, you know, what does wealth do if not, you know, force the rest of us to live in perpetual debt, which causes what? But perpetual slavery. So, you know, if this elite group is at the top, who really is at the top, well, then they're in control.
Yeah, as long as we think we have to have things that are beyond our means to buy, and therefore we accept the debt that they will lay on us, they'll loan you money. I mean, hell, the mob will loan money to you. You know?
Yeah, that's true.
And as long as you accept the debt, then yeah, they're in control. It's the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. But yeah, I think that's a defect in our thinking more than it is that these guys really have something special about their lineage. However, when I ask you about Astra Albus, what does that mean?
I don't know. I mean, the Astra, I don't, you know, I have it in the book. I'd have to go to that, you know, section of the book to, because there were so many terms that were thrown out. But, you know, honestly, you caught me right there, Kevin. I'd have to look it up in the book.
Okay, it's not important.
There's a lot of data there, and I'm not actually retaining all of that data.
Okay.
You know, in my head, there's so much of it. I mean, there was other sections of the book, but I remember Albus meaning I want to say light. I want to say Albus meant light.
Yeah, so does Lucifer.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a good one.
Okay, so, let me make a statement about them, and then we'll move on, because I want us to get to what happened in 1979. And my statement is, you know, if I have to choose between ETs who could turn this planet into a little wisp of smoke in space and have not done so, if I had to choose between them and the Astra Albus elites who think they have a divine right to rule me, my vote goes for E.T.
Sure.
You know? Mm-hmm. All right. But it's good to know that these Astra Albus cats are out there and that...
And by the way, Astra Albus means illumination, light bringers, immaculate ones. Those are some of the other terms that they were referred to.
Yeah. And it's really true that Lucifer means light bearer.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
Okay, now, in 1979 is when the Colonel got involved with this, because there had been another conflict. So we've got here with these Greys, the Muroc expedition goes in to this cave, and they see evidence that there's been a conflict between the Apaches and some kind of little not human things, because they see the skeletons laying around. And then the Muroc expedition, they get into a conflict.
Yeah.
And, in fact, at least one of their guys, and maybe two, were killed by these Greys.
Yes.
Okay? And then in 1979, there's yet another conflict.
Mm-hmm.
What's this about?
Well, in 1979, there had been rumors among the scientific contingent working there that the Greys, these lower-level Greys, you see, there were two groups of Greys. You had your dissident Greys, which was this younger faction that was working closely with the human population, and these lower-level Greys, which were kind of, you know, they kept themselves a little bit more distant. They were really adherent to this doctrine that they followed, and it kind of prevented him from integrating, you know, at a much higher or closer level, as did the dissidents, that's why they were called the dissidents, this other group, because they really didn't espouse to that doctrine, and they wanted nothing to do with it. So, because they understood that, you know, why are we worshiping a group that, you know, tried to kill us and sent us here essentially to our demise?
Okay, so for the audience, let's clarify this. Two things. When you talk about lower level, we're actually talking about levels in the cave. And
right.
The first three levels, well, the first two levels were pretty much occupied by the military and civilians that worked at the base that has now been installed.
Yes.
The third level down is where there's some interface and interaction between some of the Greys and the humans. Below that level level 4, 5, 6, 7, however far it goes, the humans were not allowed to go there. And so when you talk about lower level grays, you're talking about the grays who stayed at level 4 and below. And then there's some dissident grays who come up to level 3 and they work in kind of a lab there.
That's right. So they actually work on labs on the top level. No, are you saying the lower level grays coming up to level 3?
No. The dissidents.
Yes, no. So the dissidents actually worked at the top levels with the humans, but they had their own, when you read the book, it talks about how they had their own special, corridors with the special types of lighting because of their vision.
Yeah, and temperature and humidity and so forth.
That's right.
Okay, so, now, one other thing we need to clarify. You said the progenitors had put them there to die. Tell us about that.
About them being sent there to die?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So what happened is that this third group, remember the Astra Albus I had told you about?
Mm-hmm.
Earlier than them, the Anu. When the progenitor race had created the Anu, they had also created these Alola Gray. And they had warned the Anu that to always keep the numbers of these Grays in check because they were overseeing this human population, they're always, therein laid the foundation for them becoming too powerful, possibly, one day. So there was this strict oversight from the Anu to the Alola, which were the Greys. And what happened was, by the time the Anu died off and the first of the Astra Albus were in place, that did in fact happen. The Greys became too powerful, and at one point there was some type of like a Grey revolt against the Astra Albus, but the Astra Albus were still more powerful at that time, and they shut down that revolt. So that did, that was sort of a prophetic, piece of advice from this original progenitor race, down their lineage, saying, keep an eye on this group, they're here to serve you, but because of their oversight of this human population and their high level of intelligence, they could, effectively pose a threat, and they did. So when they did pose this threat, and after everything had settled down, the Astra Albus had somehow secretly infected these low grays with something that was that made them very, very sick and made them highly susceptible, much more than the Astra Albus, to the Earth's environments. So, unbeknownst to the Greys, the Alola Greys, this was happening to them for a malevolent purpose, they looked to the Astra Albus for help, and the Astra Albus put them in the caverns of Dulphy, telling them that this was an ideal place for them, to sustain their population and work on repairing whatever was wrong with them, and that's why they were put there.
And then they discovered, I guess, at some point that, hey, we've been abandoned here to die.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, according to the Colonel, in 1979, there was some kind of really big conflict. What happened?
In 1979, that's right. So we had started down this road earlier. So there was this, there had been rumors of human abductions that had been taking place. And there were experiments that had been worked on jointly between the human scientific contingent and the lower level grays, not the dissident grays. They were working on stuff, but not with respect to whatever this joint program was for, just genetic research. And somebody had made the discovery that, in fact, there were humans that had been abducted illegally, you know, outside of this charter that had been created, you know, this accord that had been created and established between these Greys and, you know, the government. So somebody had gone down. I believe it was actually Contra, a scientist, just a plain old scientist that had gone down and breached, level 4, and they made the discovery that there were humans down there, and that triggered it. That's what triggered this this fighting, because they alerted DSD-3, which in turn went down there. When DSD-3 went down, it erupted into a full-scale, you know, firefight.
And the base was evacuated and sealed for 2 years, right?
That is right. They had enacted, this triggered a set of protocols which enacted a demilitarized zone, a full-blown DMZ. And what they did was is they kept a bare-bones minimum population there, just DSD-3, barely anyone from Installation Command, and I think just a small... small population of people from the scientific contingent to help maintain the, because you can't just abandon a scientific facility that has nuclear reactors and whatnot. So they had to have somebody there maintaining, you know, a lot of the systems.
Okay, at this point, I want to share a little bit of information about the area where this thing is located. This base actually has this Dulce underground base, according to the colonel, actually has three locations connected underground by tunnels. And the main installation is directly under the Archuleta Mesa. Now, the Archuleta Mesa is located in very far north New Mexico and very far south Colorado. It spans the state lines. It's not small, and those who are watching on our TV channel are looking at an aerial photograph of Archuleta Mesa, but you're only looking at about one-eighth of it. It's big. It's not just an outcropping that you can climb over in a day. It's big. It goes across the state lines. Part of it is in Apache territory, Apache American Indian territory. Part of it is in Ute territory across in Colorado. So the Archuleta Mesa is big. And as folks can see from the photograph on our TV channel, it's very, very rugged. Now, this is an aerial photograph, and we're looking at ravines that may be, 100, 150 feet deep. It's very, very rugged, and would be the ideal place to have
people away.
Yeah, to have something underground and hidden entrances. You can stand off away from the Archuleta Mesa, and you can see part of it. But the whole thing is big. And it's honeycombed with tunnels. We'll talk about that when we come back from this break.
Okay.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Anthony Sanchez. And when we went away for break, I was giving you a little bit of information about the area here in the United States where the colonel says this is located. And we took a look, for those who are watching our show, at an aerial photograph of Archuleta Mesa. It's big. It's too big to get in one picture here. And so there's a lot of area out there, a lot of places where this thing could be, a lot of places where the entrances could be. it would be very, very, very challenging to find it. Although in your book, the Colonel gives descriptions of how to find some of it. Now, this area, there are tunnels, according to him, that connect the three different parts of the base. And on the screen, on the TV channel, is a picture of a U.S. Air Force tunnel boring machine. And this is from 1982. Now, you may be wondering how I know that's from 1982. It's because that sign that's up there on the side of the hill, you can't read much of it, but if you blow it up and enhance the contrast, you can read 1982 on it. That is an old tunnel boring machine. The tunnels that go under the English Channel and connect between England and the continent, those tunnels were bored by machines so large that they had to be put together underground in chambers that were 65 feet high. This is a baby compared to that. So, you know, the tunnel boring machine technology certainly has improved and gotten much larger than what was in that picture. And we hear that now they actually have tunnel boring machines. Don't know if it's true, but we hear that they are atomic powered. All right, now, with all these tunnels and stuff that connect all these parts of the base, and they had to shut it down for a couple of years, how did they, because of this conflict, how did they actually get this back open?
I'm sorry, that last part, you cut off.
How did they get the base back open?
After the hostilities?
Yes.
Okay, so it took a couple years, right?
Yeah.
And before they could resume, you know, a full-scale operations again, it took a couple years. And there were these diplomatic efforts that had to take place. And essentially, the government is not in the business of giving up something that, you know, benefits them highly, which was the technology exchange between them and the Greys. So they had to resume that. So somebody stepped in at a much higher level and facilitated this diplomatic effort. And lo and behold, before you knew it, they started working full scale with the Greys again. And unfortunately for the dissidents, this new darker, malevolent element from the government side betrayed them, which was part of this deal with the lower level Greys, who had much more promising technologies. And that's a shame. That's what happened, apparently, according to the Colonel.
All right, according to the Colonel, who was it that stepped in? Who stepped in and started diplomatic contact with these Greys again?
I want to say Dick Cheney, but I can't. Anyway, that's a joke. But there was strong speculation that this group was the Austro Albus itself, or elements of the Austro, controlled elements of the Austro Albus.
Within our government.
Within our government.
Okay. How many Greys are there?
They maintain their numbers to about 1,000.
Okay, now, that's at this Dulce base. Are there other, I'll say, nests of Greys in other parts of the world?
I want to say yes. My understanding is that there are Greys in Australia in the Pine Gap facility. And these are the same Greys from Dulce. And there's also another interesting bit of information here. There's supposedly was a group of Greys, you know, some you know, many, many thousands of years ago, that actually left Dulce part of the civil war that occurred between, when they had much larger numbers, by the way, probably in the tens of thousands, I would imagine, that they left for the other side of the planet, and they ended up in the Tibet region, China. And these are your Dropa, these people that are called the Dropa.
Okay.
Those grays somehow, I don't know how, essentially factored into some indigenous population that was there. Maybe they had their own abilities, you know, their own capabilities to genetically, you know, integrate with the human species, and that's the story on the Dropa, that
All right.
this that they actually have ties, direct ties, to this gray population.
All right, now we, in the UFO community, we've heard this rumor for years now that there was a meeting between President Eisenhower and some extraterrestrials in which the extraterrestrials offered to help get rid of the grays because they're bad news. The colonel actually says that the grays are malevolent, and they're not good. He says they are malevolent. He says the Astra Albus are malevolent.
That's right.
All right. So these ETs come along and meet with, if this rumor is true, and it's a rumor, but they meet with President Eisenhower, and they offer to get rid of the grays. And they say, look, these guys are bad. They're hostile. They're malevolent. And Eisenhower turned down the offer because the ETs did not offer to exchange any technology. Okay, so then we throw our lot in with these grays, and whom the colonel says are malevolent. Is it possible that these grays know, and in fact they do know, that they were put there to die? Is it possible that they are using humans and giving little tidbits of technology here and there and using the humans as a cover to keep the ETs from blasting them out of the ground?
Possibly. That's a darn good guess. I never thought of it in that way, Kevin. So I applaud you. That is a very, very good bit of speculation. I think that is highly possible. That is highly possible. I think that these grays pose a threat to these Astra Albus because they know a lot about them, obviously.
Yeah, well, but then why didn't the Austra... Yeah, but if they pose a threat to the Astra Albus, and the Astra Albus understand that, why did they reestablish diplomatic relations with them?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very, very complex paradigm that we're discussing here. It's not so much... It's not so black and white. You have, you know, billions of dollars, you know, invested in weapon systems, defense systems, making lots of people very, very, very wealthy. So you have all these variables that you have to consider. It's not so black and white. It's like, we want them dead. It's like, well, you know, they're providing us with technology that they have. So maybe somewhere along the line, the Astra Albus lost that technology, but the Greys maintained it. So there's give and take. There's two sides to these. There's two sides. You know, to mm-hmm. To the equation. Well, there's multiple sides because you have the non Astra Albus human factor, which would be your standard typical, you know, government worker. Where do they fit into the equation?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a complex paradigm. It's much more complex, and it's not as black and white as we want to believe.
All right, now, this base that we all refer to as the Dulce base, this base, according to the colonel, its official U.S. government designation is Rio Arriba Scientific and Technological Underground Auxiliary. And he says, you quote him in your book as saying that he doesn't think that this has ever been made public before now.
That's right.
He says that the in some of the government documents, if you can find them, it'll be referred to as Rio, Rio Arriba CO or Rio Aux, A-U-X. And the people that work there just call it Rio Arriba or Dulce Facility. Now, because of the fact that the Archuleta Mesa crosses, you could say it either that it crosses into Colorado, or you could say it, if you're looking at it from Colorado, you could say it crosses into New Mexico. Because of that, it's significant that it's called the Dulce Facility.
That's right.
That means that at least the main part of this thing is on the New Mexico side.
That's right.
Okay.
I would say that when you look at a topographical aerial photograph of Dulce, of the Archuleta Mesa, you can see that the majority of it is within Rio Arriba County on the New Mexico side.
Okay. All right. So, very likely then we're talking about the thing being in New Mexico. It's called Rio Arriba, he says, and that's A-R-I-B-B-A. Were you able to nail that down? Were you able to find any indication that this Rio Arriba designation actually exists?
I'm still in the process of filing Freedom of Information Act requests to quite a few places trying to get information back. I've only got maybe back about 5% of the amount of requests that I've sent out. And it's all superficial at this point. I'm not receiving anything, so no.
Okay. It is on his DD-214, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And what did you find when you tried to check that out?
So I called the custodian of military records, the National Personnel Records Center, and I asked, you know, initially what it meant, you know, what did what did Rio Arriba Aux, you know, DSD-3 mean? And I actually got some interesting feedback because at one point I was told it means nothing.
We have to step away for break. We'll come back to the DD-214 and the Rio Arriba designation. Right after this, folks. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Anthony Sanchez, the author of UFO Highway, and we are talking about what's in that book. Anthony, I have to confess, when I cut you off, I forgot what we were talking about. Do you remember?
We were talking about, you know what? I'm sorry, Kevin. I too.
It was a good try, Anthony. Good try.
We've covered so much. I've lost track too.
All right. I apologize, folks, but I'm doing a whole bunch of stuff during these breaks. You can't imagine. But anyway, I want to. We only have a few minutes left anyway before we open up the telephone lines in our after-hours session. you ask the colonel at one point, as a matter of fact, it's on page 117 in your book, you said, are you saying the Grays are the good guys? Now, I want to just read one statement that he makes. I'll summarize the paragraph. He says, no, they're the lower-level Grays we know today and the Austra Albus are both malevolent species. Okay, but now, he says, but both groups have underestimated humans.
That's right.
How have they underestimated the humans?
Well, I mean, you have to consider the fact that we're not this unintelligent indigenous species of the planet any longer. We were genetically modified by the Austra Albus, you know, some 250,000 years ago, 200,000 years ago, you know, making, you know, modern human, creating modern human. When they created us for the purposes of interbreeding with them, they had to genetically modify us, and one of the modifications obviously was intelligence, the ability for high levels of intelligence. So this created another group that they would potentially have to contend with. So not only the Austra Albus, but the Grays. So the Grays, you know, I think both the Austra Albus and the Grays have underestimated how, you know, powerful that the humans have become over this time, probably ignoring, the evolving nature of the species.
All right, so the Grays are dying out, and the Austra Albus have pretty much bred themselves out of existence. That means, yes, then, that the so-called Austra Albus that we see today mostly are pretenders to the throne, and basically they're just humans that have decided to be monsters by trying to rule the rest of us.
Yes.
So, and there's no reason to ever fear something that has a heartbeat, because it's not at all certain yours is the one that will stop.
That's a good, yeah. You have ability to come up with these great things, Kevin.
I like freedom, man. I like freedom.
Yeah. So, you know, we have this situation where, so when you look at the picture from a higher perspective, what you see is you have these Grays. I believe, in my heart, I believe the Grays have the most advanced technology of all three groups. Three groups being the Austra Albus, the Grays, and the humans. Because now you have this group of super intelligent, you know, humans, which I don't know how intelligent we would have evolved, you know, without intervention. But, you know, how long it would have taken us to obtain this level of intelligence. But when you start taking, I mean, just take a look at the advances in technologies going back to the 40s. You know, how different is humanity today than it was from back in 1940? Very different. I mean, we have these advanced levels of technologies which have done wonders and maybe bad things for the human species. I mean, look at our population. Our population has increased. Why? Because of advancements in medical technology. I mean, we have the ability to, you know, now instead of living to a median age of 38, 35 years old, we're now living well into our 70s. So you've seen this huge population boom. You have this ability to communicate on a level never seen before, you know, with the advent of the internet, wireless communications, networking technology, fiber optics, you know, and with the ability to perform high level, you know, high speed computational, mathematics, you know, using supercomputing systems, we're able to, you know, conceive systems, you know, that have, you know, that are of a devastating nature, and then are of a of a you know, positive nature, you know.
So, well, and by the way, the colonel told you that regarding Colonel Philip Corso, that the guy was telling the truth.
Yes.
And of course, Corso was talking about bringing these technologies that he thought were alien. But he talks about bringing, how he went about bringing those into production for mainstream humanity.
Well, that is a, you know, what I like to point out about Corso is this. We have gotten two stories about Philip Corso. We got the story that essentially said, okay, here's this guy, he told us his story, we checked it out, and lots of his story falls apart once you start digging deep into it. I actually spoke with Stanton Friedman when I met him in New Mexico, and I sat with him for about probably an hour talking with him, and we spoke about Corso, and he was telling me how, you know, when he did his checking into Corso, that Corso had claimed he was part of the president's the Security Council, and that there was never any documentation to substantiate that. And there are people that are saying, oh, well, Corso was saying how one of the technologies that derived through this intervention with the Greys was night vision. And they're saying, oh, that's a lie, because the Germans were already developing night vision as far back as 1936, 38. They had, you know, their early night vision technology. And
yeah, but the colonel, your colonel, that you interviewed, addresses that. And he says, yeah, that's true, but as soon as we found the Greys and the technology they had, the night vision that they were capable of was so much better than the Germans, we abandoned the German stuff.
We abandoned that technology, and we jumped directly into the development of which is understood as Gen 2, specifically Super Gen. So the technology being developed by the German military in 38, 39, I think it was 39, we abandoned that. I mean, we didn't have a need for it. We had already, you know, jumped into this you know, higher functioning technology.
All right, we are almost to the end of what would normally be the end of our show. And I realize that some of our affiliate stations have to go on and do something else. I understand. For those who wish to continue listening, you may do so either, well, you just go to kevinsmithshow.com and you can listen to the rest of the show right there. We're going to go into after hours and open up the telephone lines. The way that works is we'll take a brief break here in just a moment. And then, like right now, and when we come back, we'll be in after hours. All right. Welcome to After Hours here at the Kevin Smith Show. And what we're going to do is open up the telephone lines. And the way this works is if you call, we'll stay after hours. We'll stay with it while you're calling. If you don't call, we'll call it a night and say thank you, God bless you, and have a nice night. Okay? So it's going to be up to you. If you wish to ask any questions of Anthony, if you wish to make any comment, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. And the toll-free number is 888-223-4599. If you live outside of the USA and you live outside of Canada, I do not have a toll-free number outside of the USA and Canada, but I do have something called Flash Message. And all you have to do is go to my website, scroll down, you'll see a picture about tonight's show, and to the right of that, you will find a link that says flash message. You can use that to send me your question or your comment. But you must be outside of the USA and outside of Canada. If you're in the USA and you're in Canada, it is a TALK talk show, and that means we have telephones for you, and I will even pay for the call. 623-444-5889 or 888-223-4599. Anthony, let me get back to this. Well, let's take this call. I've had 2 hours asking questions, so I'll take this call and we'll let the audience participate with us. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Anthony. It's Taurus calling from the United Kingdom, and it's really, really early in the morning.
Well, Taurus, I guess it must be, let's see, what, 4 o'clock, it's 5 o'clock in the morning?
No, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, darling.
Yeah.
Hi, Taurus. It's nice to meet you.
Hi, Anthony. Anthony, I've got a question for you, and you're not going to like this, but I'm going to say it anyway, okay? Why have you been typing all the way through the show?
Typing?
Yeah.
No, you are.
We can hear you. Why have you been typing all the way through the show?
I thought that was Kevin, actually.
I thought about that. I'll tell you what that is, Tors. It's happened before. Uh-huh. We have some morons that have our phones tapped, and they have an open mic. And
I'm
giving Kevin my undivided attention. I promised him that. We had a whole discussion on this.
Yeah.
Cool,
no,
that's okay, right.
I'm not considering
myself duly called off, and I apologize in advance. Right, okay, we'll get back to what I was thinking of. Okay, I was stunned when I read the book, and obviously I have been in communication with Kevin and a few other people about it. Because it is, it's mind-blowing, you know. And when certain people have an ability whereby when they're talking to someone or someone's giving them information or if they're reading something, it's an ability to be able to tell whether or not someone is actually telling the truth. Now, I have this ability. I never understood what it was. And I read the book, and I would say that 99% of it is absolutely bang on. This colonel, as far as he knows, is telling you the truth as to what he knows. But, and this is a but, all the way through, I was reading it, I was like, oh my God, look at this information, oh my God. And then all of a sudden, it came to where the greys came from, and the Aloha, and the Ostra Albus, and the Anu, and all of a sudden, all my alarm bells started ringing. Now, I can't say for sure that the information that we're being given isn't correct, but I do have other sources, as you well know, Anthony, as to the information as to where the greys did come from, who they are, and who actually made them, and why. So this is the only part that is really niggling me, because it smacks of Sitchin, and it smacks of a route that someone would want to take with this information. Also, there's another thing that I can't understand. Why nowhere in the book does anybody mention what the Air Force actually named them, which is EB, Extra Biological Entity. In 1947, Dr. Brock, under the Truman Initiative, said that these greys were to be named EB until a more suitable name occurred for them at some point in the future, and nowhere in the book is it mentioned even once.
Now, two good questions. Let me get to the first one. So,
okay.
So, it is possible that the information that the DSD-3 personnel, received and put into their repository, It could hold information that was fed to them by the greys. We could suppose that some of these tablets that were given to them were filled with a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah,
so that could answer, that. But I don't think so. I think I think what the information that they have is factual and needs to be studied a bit further. Your second question with regards to the EBEs, right?
Yeah.
I think from the perspective of the colonel, remember, this is coming from the perspective of one person. It's the colonel, his interview. And I think he was accustomed to calling them the inhabitants or the Aloha simply based on the fact that he was so close to them and he worked there. You know, so I think that's what prompted that. I think it's simply based on the fact that he worked there and they intimately knew them as Aloha or inhabitants at that facility. Outside of that, you know, they could have referred to them as EBEs. By the way, I'm hearing that typing again right now, and I'm not typing, but I'm hearing it.
Well, there you go. Let's face it. Let's not be naive enough to think that this show nor anything else to do with this book is not going to be under somebody else's scrutiny rather heavily.
Yeah.
Well, and I've caught these guys.
We know that the information that the colonel has given us, up to a degree, well, in my opinion, is correct, and it is blown everything wide open, and will continue to do so. And you're going to be very busy.
Yeah. There's still a lot of research that needs to be performed.
There is.
Yeah. But I'm glad that I have, you know, since I've come out with this information, I've had such an outpouring of support and people encouraging me to continue on with this work, not to give it up. And I've also had some great input from people who have solid information on the Greys, on the government, on the nature of underground facilities, not just here in the United States, but around the world, like in China and in Australia and Russia. So this isn't the only underground facility, you know. This is something that we have to accept. So that's something I wanted to point out.
Open the floodgates, or really crack those cracks that are already appearing.
Yes.
In the information that needs to come forwards for the rest of us to be able to put this puzzle together to figure out what's going on, because it can't continue any longer.
Yeah.
All right, Tors, I have to move along. I want to thank you so much for staying up, and thank you so much for making this call.
A pleasure, boys, pleasure.
Yes,
I'll speak to you again,
Tors,
soon.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, that typing in the background, look, I didn't say any more about it because... I've caught them before, and they really are morons. I mean, these guys, you know, I'm not going to say how it is that they are messing up, but we've even recorded their voices before. I know how they're messing up. They don't. They're jerks. And I've even recorded their voices before. Okay.
Wow.
Let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, Kevin, this is Rusty from Michigan.
Hi, Rusty.
Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Rusty.
Hello. I was wondering, with your research with your book and what the colonel, I guess it was colonel, that was telling you the information, do you think that has any relevance with some of these sightings and things that's going on now with what happened at Dulce? In other words, do you think that's going to play a role in what's the disclosure?
You know, right now, there's a huge disclosure. There's these patterns of disclosure that we're seeing. You have the Vatican making statements. You have former NORAD officers coming out with their own books filled with information. And we just had this event recently at the National Press Club with Robert Salas and these other, former military personnel who, you know, swear that they had these interactions with flying saucers. Well, my belief is that all these interactions with these extraterrestrials are actually sightings of Greys in gray flying, you know, disk technology, and they do have a vested interest in us, you know, destroying the planet, because it's their planet too. They were created here, they're indigenous to this planet as well, and so I think that I think there's a connection there.
Okay, and yeah. Then something else I noticed was like this Dulcie deal, and I have a son-in-law that's half Navajo and belongs to the Navajo reservation in Arizona, and there seems to be a lot of these tunnels and different type of bases on Indian land. Did you, during your research, did you cover, I mean, is there a reason for that?
Well, I think that this particular instance has to do with circumstance, you know, where they found it, who was already there. But it makes sense that they would, you know, stay there, construct a, you know, they would augment the facility because, you know, they're in an Indian reservation, which is a sovereign nation in itself, and they can cut deals with them, and no one's going to say otherwise.
Right.
So it makes sense that you know, that could also, help facilitate the development of a facility like that.
Okay, one more question. And I think Kevin was talking about Dulcie goes into Arizona, Colorado. Is that right, Kevin?
No. No, the Archuleta Mesa, which is north of Dulcie, New Mexico. The Archuleta Mesa goes from New Mexico into Colorado. Now, underneath the Archuleta Mesa is where the colonel says the main portion of this base is. We refer to it as the Dulcie base. It's not in Dulcie. It's north of Dulcie, according to him, and it's under the Archuleta Mesa.
Okay. Do you think that is connected to the Denver airport?
I believe so. I think that there's a connection, that there are connections between all these underground facilities that we know about. If you go to my website, UFOHighway.com, there's a link there called Top Secrets. And in top, and when you click on that link, it shows you a map of the 48 contiguous states and Alaska, and I haven't had a chance to include Hawaii on there because I know there's an underground facility there in Hawaii, a military facility, but it shows you all the various facilities. You have Realox, which is Dulcie, New Mexico, and then there's NORAD and there's Denver International in Colorado. And my understanding is that, you know, there is a connected, you know, route of high-speed train systems between these facilities.
Underground.
You know, extending all the way down to Holloman Air Force Base, and then west all the way out to China Lake Naval Air Weapons Station. Yeah.
One more question, if I can.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the military obviously could have kept these secrets, UFO secrets, with bases above ground, but yet they have chosen to hollow out all these mountains or whatever it may, mesas, whatever it may be, to put them underground. You think that may have to be something to do with, because the Grays, whoever may be involved, cannot handle our atmosphere or our sunlight as much, so they put them underground for their health reasons?
Good question. Yes, specifically with regards to the Gray this technology, definitely because of that reason. They can't operate outside like we can. So they have to operate within the confines of a hangar facility that is suitable for their physiology. And if you read the book, I cover near the end of the interview where I'm going through these photographs of Dulcie. One of them is of the hangar, and I explain, that's the TAD-1 hangar, and I explain in detail how, in addition to the hangar being, created, fabricated using the shape memory alloy, this metal, you know, for the purposes of their technology, it also covers, you know, how, you know, it's it's built specifically, you know, so that to not harm their physiology when they're there working. It's obviously not going to hurt humans, but to them, you know, it has to be, you know, under special circumstances to meet requirements that allow them to operate.
It's interesting that you mention, or the Colonel mentions in the book, actually, he mentions during the interview, that part of the problem was with Earth, it didn't have enough helium in the atmosphere for them, for the progenitor race. And the reason that's interesting is there is a person who has told me that if you traced us all the way back, which, you know, if they've genetically altered us and intermixed with us, then, you know, they are our ancestors. So if you trace it all the way back to where they originally came from, that the respirant on the home planet was helium. I have said here on the show, I find it amazing, really, that we breathe oxygen, because oxygen is one of the most corrosive elements that exists. Oxygen will bring down a skyscraper or a huge bridge, you know. Oxygen is what causes rust.
Yeah.
In fact, it's called not rust, but oxidation. It's very corrosive, and we breathe it. Helium, on the other hand, is not corrosive. And I found it kind of interesting, because I had a person that said that on this original planet that the progenitors came from, the respirant was helium.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing.
And that's before your book came out. I was told that weeks before your book came out.
Yeah.
All right, folks, 623-444-5889, or toll free 888-223-4599. We are in after hours. And that means if you wish to talk with Anthony, this is your opportunity. If you do not wish to, then Anthony and I will call it a night. But we'll give it another minute or two and see if you have a call that you would like to place. Anthony, one of the questions that I wanted to ask here is, you know, the Colonel said to you that everything at Rio Arriba, which we call Dulce Base, is controlled by the Los Alamos National Laboratory.
That's right. The facility operates under the umbrella of LANL, which, you know, is essentially an extension of the DOE, the Department of Energy, and to some extent the Department of Defense. You know, they're a heavily integrated component, although they are, you know, their own entity, you know, their own separate entity, and they're a private entity. They do have heavy involvement there for their, they hold a lot of heavy oversight of, you know, what goes on with regards to our atomic development, and just naturally as an extension because of the proximity to LANL, I guess it made sense to have them, you know, oversee, you know, operations, from the scientific and executive standpoint over for the scientific contingent at Dulce.
All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Tony from Denver.
Hi, Tony.
Yeah, I would like to thank you, Anthony, and thank you, Kevin, for a great show and going into after hours here with us.
Uh-huh. You're certainly welcome.
Yeah, good.
And thanks for tours all the way over there in England, staying up so late.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
My question for you, Anthony, would be, do you believe the grays are involved with our human souls in any way? And if so, how?
Human souls? Wow, that's a good question. I'm probably not qualified to answer that question. I'm not sure about that, actually. So, I really can't answer that question because I'm just, I don't know to what extent that they, you know, integrate with our, you know, with our species, and I'm not sure. I don't, I mean, personally, my answer would be, my feeling is no, but again, I'm not an expert in that area, so I really can't give you a strong answer. I'm sorry.
Do you believe in reincarnation at all?
Do I believe in reincarnation?
Yeah.
I don't think so. No, I'm not a big follower of like karma and reincarnation and all that. I'm not really that religious or spiritual. So I can't admit to that. No. So no, my answer is no.
Well, maybe I got an easier one that you can answer for me.
There are a lot of people that are, and I'm not. I don't hold anything against them. I have a lot of friends who believe in reincarnation. I personally just, you know, I just don't have a feeling on it one way or the other.
Okay, Tony, what's your other question?
The grays go through walls. How do they get below ground in the bases?
I have no data on them being able to go through walls. I'm not sure of that. But if they can. You know, it's probably, you know, some... Well, you know, that's interesting that you would bring that up because it's not so much as going through walls what I know about. I do know that at some point that the Alola Grays had created this genetically enhanced gray cast. It was slightly larger and stronger, and one of the features that they possessed was the ability to, sort of like a chameleon type effect, you know, they had this ability to camouflage. So I don't know if it's going through walls, but they essentially can become the wall if they needed to. But that's about as much as I know on that. I never heard of the Tories would probably know, you know, more on this than I would, but I don't know about them going through walls.
All right, Tony, thank you so much for the call. We have a flash message, and folks, it's after hours. If you wish to call, you can. The phones are open. Flash message from Mark in New Zealand, and it's very, very long, and there's no way I can get to all of it. But what happened to the progenitor Anu race that came from Mars? It would seem highly improbable that they would allow themselves to be constantly exposed to Earth's atmosphere if they knew it would eventually kill them all off. Where are they now, and where is their biosphere located here on Earth?
Yeah, there's, I don't know about any biospheres, but that is a good question. And my answer to that is that's why the progenitor race created the Anu. They were trying to create a genetically enhanced version of themselves, which could continue to stay here. And could, I mean, their technology was so far advanced, obviously, if they came here from another star system to inhabit Mars, and then through, you know, circumstance, they ended up on Earth. It's possible, it's probable that they were using their technology to create these genetically enhanced offsprings with the feeling that they were going to be able to succeed in that. And technically, ultimately, they did. You know, by the time they got to the Astra Albus, the first Astra Albus, they realized all it was going to take was some type of essence from the human species to integrate with their own to accomplish their goal, which ultimately created the modern Astra Albus, which is a successful lineage now. So they did achieve their goal.
All right. There's another part of that I'm going to read in just a moment, but let's go to the telephone. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, hi, Kevin and Anthony. This is Victoria from Washington State.
Hi, Victoria.
Hi,
Victoria. Hi. Kevin, I have a quick question for you, and then I have a couple of quick questions for Anthony. Kevin, in last weekend's newsletter, you sent us a link to an interview on YouTube by a fellow who claimed to be the last survivor of, excuse me, of the fight at Dulce, and I was wondering if this fellow who is a military man, if he was any relation to this program tonight.
Okay, what she's referring to, folks, is I sent a link to a video at YouTube, and it was Philip Schneider talking. Philip Schneider was a civilian who was employed at Dulce, and he went public and talked about it and wound up dead. The colonel does talk about him. Essentially what the colonel says is that they had a list of everyone who was supposed to be there after the firefight, so they could, you know, try to identify bodies and identify people who survived. And then his job as a psychologist was to sort of debrief them and then send them on their way. Schneider was not one of the people that they debriefed, and he was surprised later when Schneider went public, because what he wondered was, how did that guy get out of the facility without us knowing it? We assumed he was dead. So that's what he says.
Correct.
Yeah, that's what he says about that.
Thank you for clearing that up. And for anyone that doesn't know about it, you can Google, what was his name, Schneider?
Yeah, Phil Schneider.
Phil Schneider on YouTube, and there's a seven-part thing on there, on that, which is fascinating. And it kind of tells a little bit of the story that we've heard tonight. So go there and listen to it. But Anthony, I was wondering, you said that when they first went down into the sort of the cave or the structure or whatever that was underground, that there were these sheets of metal that had a cuneiform type of written language on it.
Yeah.
And that it talked about their religion. And I was wondering, did you get to see those? Did you get to see the translation of what that was? And can you tell us anything about it? And what was the reference to the religion?
Well, I mean, I never got to see any of the tablets myself. All of the tablets are locked away in something called the vault in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, according to the colonel. They've been sealed away there since.
Did you get to see any translations of it?
No, not direct. Everything was relayed to me by the colonel, he's like a walking encyclopedia of this information. I mean, he studied it, you know, the entire time that he was there. You know, it was very interesting, you know, to him, and it was something that really piqued his interest. So, with regards to the religion, that goes back to the progenitors. They worship the Greys. I don't know if it was programmed into them or they just adopted this behavior on their own, but they revered the progenitor race, the original progenitor race, and they worshiped them as gods. And they have this doctrine, a religious doctrine, which actually shaped their laws, which they follow today, that are, you know, that come from this reverence to the progenitor race. And this other group of Greys that I told you about, this younger group of Greys called the Dissidents, they oppose that doctrine, because although the older, lower-level Greys, for some reason, they stubbornly adhere to that doctrine, even though they themselves know now that the offspring of the progenitor race, the Astra Albus, attempted to kill them. So the Dissidents see this reverence to the progenitor race as a slap in the face, because they're worshiping the parents of this Astra Albus group that tried to kill them, and they don't want to have any of that. So that's why they don't espouse the doctrine. That's why these Dissidents ultimately separated from the lower level Greys and began working closely with the humans before they were betrayed. I'm positive that there's probably a Dissident faction right now.
Okay, and then the last question that I had was, do you have any of the names, you know, like of people who would be considered Astra Albus lineage that that we might recognize today?
Well,
did he name names?
He named
and
names.
And what are
I
they?
I didn't name names. Like the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, and he he even went on to mention other families like the McDonald's and the Lees and several others, but I don't have the list in front of me, but strangely enough, it correlates to what we know as the Illuminati. You know, so I asked the colonel, you know, is this the Illuminati? And at one point in, here's the part, remember, this is a direct transcription of the interview. Nothing here was changed. There's no modifications. These are his words. At one point in the conversation, in the interview, he outright says, and these are the Illuminati, and these people are the Illuminati. Then later on, near the end, when I ask him about it, he becomes noncommittal about it. So I don't know if he has reservations about them being the Illuminati. It's his own supposition that they're the Illuminati. However, when you look at the facts, he names the families that we know as to be affiliated with the Illuminati. So it's essentially, it has to be. I mean, in my mind, it has to be this group. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Fascinating show, and thank you.
Thank you for the call. 623-444-5889 or 888-223-4599. Second part of that flash message from Mark in New Zealand is, what is it about Earth's atmosphere that is not suitable for the progenitor race? Well, that's interesting. Now, we know what's not suitable for the grays. What about for the progenitor race?
Yeah, well, for the progenitor race, it had everything to do with the imbalance in the atmosphere of the levels of oxygen, helium, nitrogen. It just was not suiting their physiology. And when you look at the transcription, I don't have that in front of me right now, but it does go into a little bit of detail about it, and it tells you exactly what it was that was not right about Earth's atmosphere. And like you said, Kevin, oxygen is a very, very corrosive element, and it's highly feasible that to another species from another planet that evolved elsewhere, it's very dangerous gas to them. So that's my answer on that.
Well, yeah, if you can imagine going to a planet that has some sulfuric acid in the atmosphere, not so much that it burns your eyes or burns your skin, but it's a higher content of sulfuric acid than what we have here on Earth. You could breathe it, but it would probably cause some cellular breakdown in your lungs. It would probably cause some problems and make you live a little less long. And in other words, die a little younger. And maybe that's the kind of thing they were undergoing.
Yes.
All right.
Good question. Thanks for that question.
Very good question. We are in After Hours, and the telephone number is 623-444-5889 or 888-223-4599. And we won't prolong this. It's not like when I open the phone line in the second hour, and I'll just go on and on and on, and maybe you'll call and maybe you won't. Either you call or we go. It's that simple, because it's After Hours. 623-444-5889, 888-223-4599. The place for you to get Anthony's book is UFOHighway.com. UFOHighway.com. And I do recommend the book. I have reservations about some of the things the colonel said. I have some reservations about some of the things the colonel did, as I described. But I think overall, it's information well worth the reading, and it's information, a lot of it, that we haven't heard before. You'll have to read it and make up your own mind. You'll have to decide for yourself if you think it's accurate, and to what degree you think it's accurate. But do keep in mind that what you're reading is an interview between Anthony and the colonel. So, as he says in his disclaimer, those are the views of the colonel. And that's what he said, and that's what you get to read. Interesting stuff. Anthony, I want to thank you for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me.
And thank you for staying over for a few minutes with us so we could talk to our audience and answer some questions.
Not a problem.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap. After hours is over, and if you've been thinking, I'd like to ask a question, now they're leaving. Sorry, you're too late. You should have been quicker on the dial. We'll be back tomorrow night. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again.